All right, guys, this episode is sponsored by Responder Wipes so that we can transcribe some of these episodes and make them accessible to the hearing impaired and the foreign language speaker. So I'm not going to give you some cheesy story about how I've used Responder Wipes to save babies from burning buildings and mop up oil spills. The bottom line is when we fight fire, we are covered in crap. We try and remove our gear. We try and change our hoods. When we get back to the station, the goal is to scrub our bodies as much as we can. But obviously there's areas of our skin that are exposed, especially when we're loading hose and putting ladders away. So I love these products simply for two reasons. Firstly, they use micellar water, which is the same thing that my wife's natural makeup removers use, which are known to absorb a lot of these contaminants from the skin. And secondly, they're huge. The large size that they have is 12 inches by 24 inches. So you imagine like a drying towel. So much bigger than some of the ones that are out there. And you know, I want to have as much of that as possible to wipe down on my arms, my face, my neck, and get all that crap off me before we get back in the engine, go back and try and scrub those cancer-causing chemicals from our skin. So thank you to Responder Wipes. If you want to learn more about them, go to responderwipes.com, responderwipes.com, and learn more and find out how you can buy them. Welcome, guys, to episode 95 of Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing, and my guest this week is the back mechanic, aka Dr. Stuart McGill. This interview was incredible. Now, if you do not have a spine, you can turn off now. It's going to be of no benefit for you whatsoever, but everyone else, I highly recommend listening. We delve into an array of topics from the posterior chain, hinging, training barefoot, the direct correlation between sleep deprivation and musculoskeletal injuries, and a host of other areas. Dr. McGill is a wealth of knowledge, and he opened multiple rabbit holes that I'm going to start going down myself. So that being said, please go to iTunes, rate the show. If you use an Android app, rate the show there. And then again, as I always say, please just share it. Put it on your social media, send it to friends. You probably know 1,000 people that have back pain and then 10,000 that you wish didn't have back pain. So let's share this episode and many other episodes and get this incredible knowledge to our fellow firefighters, police officers, medics, and every other human being around the planet. That being said, I introduce to you Dr. Stuart McGill. Enjoy. All right, well, welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast, Dr. McGill. Firstly, where are we finding you on planet Earth today?
Well, I'm at home in Gravenhurst, Ontario, which is halfway between North Bay and Toronto. I believe the last 2 days are our first 2 days above freezing this year.
Well, we're on the opposite side of the spectrum here in Florida. Yeah. So, well, we mentioned this briefly before we start recording, but again, I want to offer my condolences to everyone in Toronto after that horrible attack that you guys had this week.
It's, again, being in Canada, we think we're immune to such things, but absolutely not. My mother, who's 90, called me last night in tears, and she just can't sleep thinking about the families and all involved. But it's a crazy world we live in.
It is. And I God hope one day we can figure out, you know, the common denominators behind all these attacks. So were you born in that area?
Yes.
Okay. So just briefly, what was your family unit like? What did your parents do and how many siblings did you have?
I had one sister who's 7 years younger than I. I'm married to my wife, Catherine, and I'm going to make you sick for a minute here. She has four sisters, but I've known them all my life. My dad worked for her dad, believe it or not. And I remember I shouldn't say this. I'm 5 years older, or four and a half, as she likes to say. I remember her in diapers. So
that is a bit weird.
it is a bit weird. Yeah.
No, my wife's 6 years younger than me too. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And then what did your parents do?
Well, my dad emigrated here, actually. He had Irish parents, grew up his teenage years in Liverpool, England, and then first emigrated to Australia. And I said, "Dad, why'd you ever leave?" And he just said, "Well, I got fed up of beautiful sunny weather." And he wanted a challenge, so he then emigrated to Canada. And his original plan was to be a hard rock miner, but then decided that with kids, he better get responsible. And he took an accounting course, and he ended up being an accountant at a bank. I think he was bored for the rest of his life. You know, he'd been through the war. And of course, he was in the Navy. And when that settled, he said, you know, it was the best and worst of times. So exciting to be a young fella, you know, commanding a small gunboat, and then spent the rest of his life bored to tears, I think.
It's hard to match that adrenaline, though, World War II.
Yeah.
All right. So when you were young, I mean, obviously you're well involved with athletes and tactical athletes as well. Were you a sportsman yourself?
Well, yes. I don't want to give the wrong impression, though. I was not a natural athlete by any stretch. But in high school, I played American football. And in fact, that's what took me to university. I really had no academic interest at all. I was on track to be a plumber. And I went to university, and the football coach said, "Well, what do you want to study?" And I said, "Well, I really have no interest." And he said, "Good, we stick you guys in physical education." So I actually started in phys ed, but with meeting some professors who were very influential, I ended up taking mathematics and physics. And then, long story short, I then took my did a master's in biomechanics, primarily because at that time I was interested in road cycling. So I went to the University of Ottawa so I could ride my bike in the French Gatineau part of Canada. And then I was playing hockey with the professor's team at the University of Ottawa. And it's like rugby, I guess, which is a game you're familiar with. The professors play different universities, and the host team, everyone sits in the same dressing room afterwards and has a beer together after they've beaten the hell out of one another for a couple of hours. And I sat beside a professor from Waterloo named Bob Norman, and he just happened to say, "Why don't you come and see my lab?" And I did. And I switched to spine biomechanics for my PhD. So that's how I ended up being a professor of spine biomechanics.
Brilliant. Yeah, I went through the University of Florida exercise physiology program, and it was great. But I was not destined to stay within the educational system.
Right.
So from that point, then were there any moments leading up to that where you had encountered either your own back injuries or seen other people that you kind of had an aha moment that was another area that you really want to delve into?
Well, people ask, did I end up in the spine area because of my own back? Not really. I did fracture C4 in my neck, believe it or not, playing hockey, and fractured my hip and had numerous injuries. But that wasn't the driver in this at all. I just have a personality, I think, that whatever I get into, I just study it and enjoy it. But as I became a young professor, our starting question was simple: how does the spine work? So our line of investigations were to answer that question. But I'd get invited to different medical meetings, orthopedic meetings and neurology meetings and occupational health meetings, etc., and be invited to speak about how the spine works and becomes injured. And the docs would say, "That's a very interesting perspective on disc bulges or end plate fractures," or whatever the topic was. "Would you come and see a patient with us?" And I said, "Well, no, I'm not a clinician." And they'd say, "Well, don't worry, we will be there with you." And I learned very quickly that our perspective was very different than the traditional medical model. And I was trained quite quickly then to see patients. And I mean, as you know, now I've retired from the university, and I have a clinic at my home here, and athletes now fly in from around the world for a consult, because for the first time, we are honing in on a precision diagnosis. And once they have that, they now know very precisely what to stop doing so they don't mimic the causation mechanism. And then we guide them on what they need to build to create a foundation for pain-free activity. And whether that is working on the fire ground as a firefighter, or it's to get the gold at the next Olympics. We define what the demands of that task will be. We see if their body currently has the capacity to meet those demands. If they don't, we then create the training program and select the most appropriate training tools to get them there in the most efficient way.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I want to start at the very beginning. So you look at a lot of, I guess you'd say, less developed countries around the world, and it appears that they have very well-functioning bodies, you know, through to late elderly time. You see, obviously, pictures of elderly women in the Southeast Asia in paddy fields still working, you know, pulling out the rice, and African ladies carrying water, and obviously these very generic National Geographic images. But then you see us, and you know, I know from the path that I've delved down, things like sitting have really created a lot of problems. So from you, pretty much one of the top people on spine, what is it that Western culture is doing to the human body that's creating some of these issues that you're seeing?
Well, I don't know if I necessarily agree that Asians and Africans and European Caucasians and whatnot have all that a differential rate in some of the back issues. There's certainly different back issues and different exposures, but as I've traveled to these areas, I'm still dealing with back pain. However, having said that, from an anthropological point of view, which is not my area of expertise at all, of course, the new relatively new exposure to computers and cell phones and the amount of time that people spend sitting does create a very specific stress for the back. Then if we look at the typical American who walks very little, walking is absolutely essential for spine health and many health systems in the body. I mean, it's the best way to train the quadratus lumborum, the obliques, etc., in a way that pretty much guarantees spine stability and hip mobility and all the rest of it. So it's that balance that is being lost. And then they go to the gym to try and make up for it. Whereas I don't think that pattern of sitting for 8 hours and then going for a very intense workout for 1 hour at the gym would be quite as typical, say, in other areas of the world. But having said that as well, the anatomy is quite different. I mean, I don't know how specific we want to get down into this, but I should probably conclude with this, because this is probably the point that will be most interesting to your listeners. In my world, all back injuries and all back pain has a very precise cause. So in the North American medical system, there is no provision for a person to get a precise diagnosis of their back pain. They go to the medic, they might get 10 or 15 minutes, and they kind of guess as to what's causing the pain. When we assess a patient, we spend usually around 3 hours to go through the full pathways to their pain. We start out with an interview, and I just let them talk and never before. Has anyone ever listened to what their passions are, what the physical exposures are, why they have failed previous attempts at back rehab? Because no one asked them to describe what the impediments were. And I'll give you an example. Say you have a person who's been told, well, you should go out and walk three times a day. But then the person reveals in that conversation, she'll say, well, I don't want to walk out in my neighborhood when it's dark. I don't feel safe. So what do you think the compliance would be to that healthful practice? It's going to be zero. So until you just listen and find out why the person has failed, you're going to fail again as well. So that's the beginning of it. And then pain pathways form clusters and patterns. And once a pattern starts emerging, then we will ask very specific questions. You know, if they describe a pattern of back attacks where they might say, well, I sneezed and I threw my back out, or I picked up a pencil and threw my back out, or I reached and flushed the toilet and it felt like someone threw a knife in my back, I would then say to them, when you roll over in bed, have you ever had a sharp pain? And if they said yes, this is the sure sign of spine instability. So there's micro movements occurring at a spinal joint that's trapping a nerve. And they will have, they may even be locked up for 4 or 5 days, and then it slowly dissipates over the next couple of weeks, and then they're fine again. Living in fear, not knowing when the next acute attack will occur. Well, that scenario I've just described has a very specific cause, and it is really quite simple to give them a movement strategy that completely eliminates the mechanistic cause. So now all of a sudden you show them that they are completely empowered. All of the movement fear goes away. So if we're talking of a firefighter now, they can pull on their boots, bend down, pick up a hose, advance a loaded fire hose into the the battle, so to speak, and they just know how to move and zero risk of an occurrence. But you know, the next person comes in and tells much more of a slow onset, slow recovery, episodic kind of pain. So I guess in a nutshell, people have been told they have chronic back pain. Almost always when you hone in on the mechanism, it's not chronic back pain at all. It is many acute attacks throughout the day because of the way that they're moving that's causing stress concentrations on the pain mechanism. They just keep picking the scab. But once they're shown how to wind down the mechanism, those tissues desensitize, become less painful, we know what the healing and adaptation should now be, because we've defined that, so we can give them proper training and rest ratios, and then we rebuild the foundation that individual needs to move pain-free, whether it's on the fire ground, in the police force, playing in the NFL, or they just want to be a stay-at-home mom, they've got a new kid, and their biggest challenge is it's 2 o'clock in the morning and the baby needs feeding. How do you pick that child out of the crib in a way that is bulletproof for the back? So anyway, that's it in a nutshell.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you walk around, you know, England, you walk around America, is the two places I'm at most of the time recently. And you see, and this is from, again, a very, very, what's the right word? Novice set of eyes with mine, but you see the feet splayed out. You know, the pronation of the feet. You see the anterior pelvic tilt. The shoulders pull forward, and this human spine that we're getting now. It seems you see a lot in our fellow men and women. Just seems like a recipe for disaster. So the Da Vinci's man, the way he holds himself in that painting is. Is that the goal, to try and maintain that? I mean, these things that I'm seeing with my eyes, are they the same kind of diagnostic tools you're looking at when it comes to posture?
Well, yes, it is. Once you get enough foundational knowledge. Your eye is the best pattern recognizer that there is. It's better than any instrument. But, you know, when I go back to the university now, and in my last years when I was at the university, I hate to use this word, but it was almost disgusting, viscerally disgusting to me to watch the majority of young people almost crippled walking around campus, how they would, it's okay now to be disrespectful of your body, have incredibly poor posture. And I think in some of the cultures that you were describing earlier, it's not acceptable to be disrespectful for your body to the point where it's disabled through very poor fitness, very poor posture. But it's now become acceptable. So that's one thing, the amount of time that people sit, and then when they have a break, they get on their phone. This is not conducive to good health. Even the walking style, as you described with the feet out, when you measure an obese person walking, they don't have a spring in their knees because their knees cannot tolerate the weight. So they, if you watch, and it's a walk that people use when they walk in sandals or flip-flops, for example, in Florida. They throw their feet forward and lock their knee hard into extension. And I see young people walking this way now, which we never used to see before. And it is an obese gait pattern that they're copying almost from one another, but it's the most unathletic, joint-conserving method. So I don't know if I'm a bit off topic there or not, but...
No, that was great. I'm seeing so many common denominators. The more of these episodes I do, the more of these lines intersect. And I just had an interview with Dr. Gregory Smith, who... had a couple of documentaries about the opiate epidemics, and he said exactly the same thing. He's like, when I sit down with my patients, I talk to them for, I believe it was about 3 hours as well, his initial consultation, and again, to delve into their pattern and what's the history of their addiction. And that seems to be something that we're really lacking in modern day medicine, is they're having to bang through these patients to get, you know, whatever insurance money they're trying to get. And the people that are losing are the men and women that are walking through those doors.
In many ways, you know, I think the medics who spend 10 minutes with a person with back pain and then they give them Demerol or a narcotic for their back pain, when in fact their back pain was so simple to address the cause, but they are untrained and didn't know how to assess the cause, and they didn't have the time that it took to do a thorough, proper assessment. If you went to the orthopod 30 years ago, you would get a good assessment. Now you will get chances are either you're passed off and told, oh, go do Pilates because you've got back pain. Well, the Pilates is just as much a chance to hurt their back as it does to help their back. It depends on what the mechanism is. But the number of back patients who are referred to me addicted. It's a real indictment of what's going on in medical practice now.
Right. So when these men and women come to you, you've done the diagnosis, you've figured out a specific movement pattern or weakness that's creating this. What does the exercise recommendations look like? And I understand everyone's completely different, but what are some of the main exercises that you do use with a lot of your patients?
Well, I have to go back one level now. That's a bit of a myth that they're going to exercise their way out of back pain. The highest priority is to get rid of the cause. So once we finish the interview stage, we then go into the clinic and we do provocative testing. We provoke their back pain so we know exactly what makes it better and what makes it worse. So we identify the specific motions, the postures, the loads that increase or decrease their back pain. And most people, unless they have something like, say, a sinister cancerous tumor that's causing their back pain, which is very rare, but if it's mechanical back pain, you will change it by changing their posture and the load and that kind of thing. So once we've defined that, we then show them, you know, every time you get out of the chair, you bend forward, you have a disc bulge. We've just proven that's causing your back pain. It's trapping a nerve root, and that's why your big toe is falling asleep. You know, that's just an example. Once we show them, before you get out of a chair, we want you to sniff a little air, sit tall in the seat, bend forward through your hips, and then transfer the weight onto your feet. You spread your knees and pull your feet underneath you. Basically, I'm teaching mechanics of weightlifting 101. Then you pull the hips through and stand up using a hip hinge. Now we've just completely eliminated the pain trigger. And they'll say, wow, that didn't hurt. No one has ever shown me that before. Good. Now we're going to show you how to bend over and brush your teeth, get on and off the toilet, in and out of your car. How do you tie your shoes? And these are all real life problems. Now, this is the phase that we call spine hygiene. If it's a firefighter, we then, when I was at the university, we had a clinic paid for by the firefighters. It had ladders. It had a mock-up of an elevator where you had to pike open the door. It had a instrumented anvil that you had to take a sledgehammer and hit so many joules of energy on the anvil to simulate breaching a door. We had a loaded fire hose advance, which was a heavy shipping rope with resistance on the end. We had a body drag. We had a obstacle course that would be filled up with vapor to simulate smoke. The guys would put on full bunker gear, go in and pull out two crash test dummies. So, you know, all of these things, they were taught to move in a way that didn't trigger their specific back pain mechanism. So this is the first stage of winding down back pain. You must desensitize the painful tissues first. And if the tissues have damage, we have to create a schedule and a regimen for the tissues to heal. Now, once we've created a body that is tolerant, we now build strategic stability and mobility. The spine is a flexible rod. It's flexible. It allows you to dance and move and enjoy life. But when you're pulling a body out of a car wreck, you better stiffen that flexible rod. Otherwise, you will create a stress concentration and it will fail. It's a structure. So the whole spine hygiene and work technique is critical. But then teaching them strategic stability of their back. When is it okay to move their back around? But when must you stiffen it through coordinated activation of the abdominal wall, quadratus lumborum, latissimus dorsi, etc. And then they may or may not, it depends on the person, need strategic mobility. They might need mobility at the hips or the thoracic spine or the shoulder joints. Then we move on to transferring this ability, and your body is an articulated linkage. It follows very specific laws and rules. We then get into patterns of pushing, pulling, lifting, carrying, all things that a physical occupational athlete, like a firefighter or a military person, requires. There you go. Now, if you're going to the Olympics, then the final stage, of course, is to ramp up and create loading that will optimize the adaptations in their bodies so that they're ready to compete in whatever it is. But that's it is a myth, though. Back exercise is going to fix my back. First of all, get rid of the cause, then strategically build the athleticism with exercise.
Right. And the area you talked about in your facility that had all the fire specific tasks, that's something that's definitely missing in all the instances that I've had. And you know, kudos to the places I've been to. They've done their best. But I mean, I would say certainly in the Florida area, a majority of the patients in the PT clinics that I go to are elderly. So they're not used to a, you know, 30 something muscular tactical athlete walk in and saying, I need you to get me strong enough to be able to drag a 200-pound person out of a building. So that's fantastic that you had that array of tools to use to get your men and women back to duty.
Well, this is the maybe I'm offending everybody in this podcast, but physical therapists are not taught athletes in their training. They sometimes are quite happy to get a person to stand up off the toilet, and that's the end of it. To work with a martial artist or an NFL football player or a police officer or a firefighter, you've got to know the job. And if you don't know the job, you shouldn't be trying to rebuild their body to meet those specific demands. So it takes a very special clinician who has knowledge. One of the joys of my life, I mean, I'm a little bit older now, but when I have, say, an athlete from the UFC, which is the MMA combat league, I love to have a role in the cage with them. I love to feel their athleticism, the demands and their techniques, so I understand what it is that they need to do. So, I mean, we always joke. I say, okay, I'm going to show you something about your back pain, but you're going to show me something about your athleticism. And every good worker has a skill set, and you can learn so much. I remember I was asked to do a consult with a hydro utility, and these are lads that go out and climb hydro poles. So the first thing I had to do was put on a pair of climbing spurs and a utility belt, and I put something over my shoulder, I forget what it was, and climb a 60-foot pole. And boy, that teaches you what the demands are of this that particular job. But you know, we've done the same thing with military, the police, and the firefighting communities.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I had a guy that I train in my gym saying he had foot pain recently. And I think, was it foot pain? Maybe it was back pain, but he was talking about doing a lot of climbing. He works for the power company, utility company, and they've been doing all the utility poles. And in their climbing shoes, the way they climb those little spikes on either side of the pole, they have to put it on the arch of their foot. They can't go on the ball of their foot, how you'd want to climb. And he said he could just feel there's no comfortable way of doing it. And then he could feel that movement pattern creating, not so much an injury, but an aches and pains within the rest of his body just from changing that from the normal climb.
Right. I know exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah. Well, I want to kind of go back to one thing that you said. So this is something that I have been enlightened to after I hurt my back, and then I preach now as well, the hip hinge. Now that's something that you would think would be natural, but as a fireman teaching my fellow peers on the fitness side, and then as a coach in the gym where I coach, it's incredible how the hinge has been lost, and all those strong muscles that were designed to use in the back, you know, the posterior chain to do these lifts, and the ability to keep the scapula back as well, is so challenging for people. Is that something that you see where you are as well?
Absolutely. Yep. And then worse yet, they then go to a gym with a trainer, and the trainer starts teaching them deadlifting, not a clue on how to strategically stiffen the body to perform the deadlift. They don't do an assessment of the person's hips, so they know the starting height. They don't teach them how to grip the bar with a double overhook, not an over and an underhook with the hands, but a double overhook, and then bend the bar, locking it down with latissimus dorsi, stiffen the core, unleash the hips, and pull the hips through to perform the deadlift. And it's quite a technical lift, and they end up far too many good men and women are being damaged, and I use that word carefully chosen, being damaged by trainers telling them they should be deadlifting their body weight. And yet they hadn't been experienced enough themselves to know what the technique was to perform a deadlift. And I will say that probably over half of the people I see as back patients have been either created or made worse by trainers not knowing their craft.
Yeah, I see that myself as well. And especially if you get, you know, I train in a CrossFit gym, and you know, you get these workouts, especially in the open that they have every year, and it will be deadlifts and it will be higher reps. And you just hear it. You hear everyone's, you know, how much pain they're in the next day, and especially in the wrong place. They're feeling it in their lower back. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but you should be feeling a deadlift really in your glutes. That's the thing that should be lifting.
You should be feeling it in your whole body if it's done correctly. But really, you shouldn't be feeling it at all. A training session should be giving you more back than it is taking away. And there's another issue. When someone says they're trashed or really sore after a training session, whoever was guiding them doesn't understand foundational biology. Every system in biology has what we call a tipping point. So I'll start the example with a vitamin. If you took vitamin D, for example, and you didn't have enough, you'd be ill. You'd be vitamin D deficient. But if you have too much, it now becomes a poison and you'll be sick. So there was a tipping point there somewhere. Exercise is exactly the same. So let's use deadlifting now as the variable in the example. If you don't do enough, you're not going to get a biological adaptation. But if you cross the tipping point, there's two kinds of patterns of back injury with deadlifting. The first pattern is they flex their spine. Their hips are too tight. They're pulling from too low a level, and they might use what is popularly known as butt wink. Their spine bends, and some trainers say, well, oh, butt wink is okay. Under heavy load, it is not. It will slowly delaminate the collagen fibers of the discs. They are not ball and socket joints. Those are your hips. The discs are fibers of collagen held together with a ground substance. They follow the laws of a fabric. And if you work the fibers back and forth under stress strain reversals in a fabric, you will get a delamination and eventually a tear in the fabric. And this is exactly the mechanism of what people will do to their discs, because they're treating them like the ball and socket joint rather than their hip. Another pattern is the deadlift is too heavy in magnitude, and they create microfracturing of the end plates. Now the fibers pull out of their connection to the vertebra because of the scaffolding has now been broken, and they don't feel this, by the way. There's no pain at this point. And now the fibers get loose because their ends are no longer fully connected. And then with more deadlifts and worse form, because they're doing 10 reps to fatigue, they then pressurize the nucleus. And with each deadlift, the nucleus works its way a little bit further through the delaminated collagen, and they end up with a disc bulge again. Never do deadlifts to fatigue. Never. Do a single with perfect form. Then put the weight down and regather your perfect form. Then do the next rep. If you want to go to the Olympics, do you think Olympians are doing 10 Olympic lifts in a row? They never would. I know it's a CrossFit competition, but it's not how you would get to the Olympics as an Olympic lifter. What you're doing is with the perfect lift is establishing what we call an engram. An engram is the representation of the movement in the brain. And with every repetition, your brain records that as muscle memory. You want to record a perfect engram, but when you do 10 lifts, you now pollute the engram with a fatigued pattern. Your brain doesn't know what to do to start lifting that heart attack victim out of the bathtub, which might be a common lift for a firefighter, for example, or any emergency personnel. You want perfect engrams and train them with singles of perfect lifts. Now, the lifts might be heavy, that's fine, but don't go to fatigue. And I can prove this, by the way. We won an award in Europe as the top study 3 years ago in the world. We took the Toronto ETF. So that was the SWAT team or the emergency task force. There were 70 officers in the ETF. We followed them for 5 years. We had zero attrition. So the same 70 officers started as finished. We measured health variables and habits, and we spent, I believe it was 6 hours assessing every single. Sorry, that was just another colleague coming through on Skype.
No problem.
Yeah, I can't prevent that. I'm sorry. But anyway, back to the police officer study. We spent 6 hours assessing their movement patterns and their strength, their mobility, their endurance, etc. Then we watched them for 5 years to see who got back pain to the point that they lost a day of work. Do you think the most fit firefighters, the ones who trained the hardest, were resilient to back injury, or those were the ones getting back injuries?
And you would assume the fit ones were the most resilient.
No, we saw exactly the opposite. And then we went in and watched them train. The ones who did 10 Olympic lifts or 10 deadlifts were breaking their perfect form, getting into fatigue, and those were the ones who were getting back injuries. So I'm not talking through my hat here. We've proven this several times. Train with perfect form. The next study we did with the Pensacola, Florida Fire Department. Once again, we started with 75 men. Yes, they were all men. One group of 25 formed a control group. The next 25 did fitness training for a period of time. Now, it was very much the style of doing, 10 burpees, which creates spine mobility, then do 10 Olympic lifts, which now you need precisely the opposite. Mobility in your spine is very detrimental. So now they had to stiffen their spine and do 10 reps. But of course, when you get tired, your spine breaks form. And then the third group were what we called the Movement Matters group. We worked with very high level coaches and trainers from, it used to be called Athletes Performance. Now they're called Exos, which they've partnered with the Andrews Institute in Pensacola. Anyway, prior to the study, we measured all the firefighters doing their fire ground tasks. We measured injury markers. So if their knee buckled inwards while they were advancing a fire hose, or they used too much spine flexion under heavy load lifting a crash test dummy or something like that. These are all markers that we know increase the risk of future injury. The ones who just trained, and I'll use the expression, I don't need to use that, but the ones who just did repeated lifting and, the coach encourages them to keep doing more reps and that kind of thing. When they went back out onto the fire ground, they were moving with more injury markers. In other words, you've created an occupational athlete, a firefighter, who's now stronger and lifting more with worse form. The third group, who had excellent coaching all the time. We never coached them on fire ground activities. We only coached them on how to do a proper hip hinge, a proper deadlift, a proper push pattern, a proper pull pattern. How do you carry objects properly? They went back out onto the fire ground with much fewer injury markers. They had a movement wisdom now that produced resilience in their body. I can prove now that good coaching is worth the money. And those who just want to train and get strong in the gym with repeated repetitions, I hope they enjoy their pain, because I can stand by that particular study.
Yeah, yeah. And then the thing is, I think it would be foolish to even question that, because that's the goal of anyone that goes to see a coach, is that they're supposed to be the leader and are supposed to be someone who will guide them into the correct movement pattern, whether it's a professional sport or whether it's, you know, a CrossFit environment or Olympic lifting or whatever it is. And I actually 100% align with you that, and I'm kind of laughed at sometimes in my gym because of my resistance to the competitions. And it's not the competitions themselves. I've got some amazing athletes that are perfectly capable of doing very well in a competition very safely. But the majority of the men and women that come to our gym aren't moving correctly, just like you said. So, you know, to them, I'm like, there are going to be no medals handed out at the end of this workout. So you've got nothing to injure yourself for in the first place, even if that was a philosophy. So do every single rep the way it's supposed to be done. And in your mind, tell yourself that if you don't do it right, imagine there will be someone giving you a no rep. So you wouldn't even be able to count that one anyway.
Well, well said.
We just paused for a moment, and you were talking about people on the internet discussing movement fear. So would you mind elaborating on that for me?
Well, there are many people on the internet who I don't feel they've done appropriate scientific investigation. And I think they're very good at marketing on the internet. And they tell people that back pain is in their head, or it doesn't matter how you move, just keep moving, because you don't want to become what's called kinesiophobic, or afraid of movement. When I get those kinds of patients, I find they are the most fearful of movement, because they never know when a certain movement will end up feeling as though someone threw a knife in their back. But when they're shown their precise mechanism of an episodic back pain and how to avoid it, they are suddenly so empowered, and all of the movement fear goes away. I'll just pull out another example of another study that we were given an award for, and it's you'll see why it's so interesting. This work could never have been done in the United States. If you're a frontline clinician, you will have had couples coming to you saying, we are now celibate because 6 months ago when we had sex, we injured our backs quite badly. And we're so fearful now that it's not worth it. And the clinicians have zero references to guide them on what to tell the patients. So this is a real problem. And what we did was, with that motivation to provide clinicians with recommendations, we then studied couples having sex. We were measuring spine load, hip load, muscle activation levels, etc. And as I said, this was not possible to conduct in the U.S. It would never have been allowed. But you can imagine the ethics concerns of the university, and we worked through it for 2 years. One of my graduate students, Natalie Sidorkiewicz, took this on as her graduate work. But anyway, we were able to create an atlas and provide that to the medical community. So now for the first time, they have guidelines on what to tell patients. So there's just yet another example of taking this fear that many clinicians will say, look, it's just in your head, don't worry about it. Well, just hold on. I've just given you an example now of massive behavior change because of fear. And the solution was not to ignore it. The solution was to study it and understand the mechanism so you can have a quantifiable and justifiable intervention to change people's lives. Anyway, it's how you get rid of movement fear. And, you know, I'm not saying the psychological is unimportant. I'm not saying that at all. Because how a person deals with chronic pain, the depression, the upset and stress on their family. You know, look how many first responders are under family pressure now because they can't earn money. It's an enormous psychological stress. However, you can go ahead and treat the psychological or in conjunction with treat what is causing their back pain. And when the pain goes away, they start sleeping better. They become psychologically more resilient. And most often, and again, I'm not talking through my hat, we follow up with every patient we've ever seen, so we know the score and the behavior. The psychological issues diminish and disappear when the pain goes away.
Yeah, again, that makes perfect sense. I wanted to kind of elaborate on that and then also to kind of tie in one of your books. So one of your books is called The Gift of Injury. When I hurt my back, which is about 5 years ago now, that phrase couldn't be more true, because what it did is it gave me an opportunity to delve into, yes, my back was hurt, but obviously just like your speciality is finding out what the hell it was that created the environment that I would even get hurt in the first place. So the philosophy of an injury being an opportunity to not only heal, but then come back even stronger, which is my goal for every time I've been hurt. Again, that seems to be a philosophy that's not very well understood in the workplace injury and then rehab arena. So when you have these men and women that come to you, is that the same kind of thing, that you're not just trying to get them out of pain, but also get them at least as strong, if not stronger, if there were weaknesses, than they were before they even got hurt in the first place?
Well, absolutely. People want me to come in and put together injury prevention programs. Well, we talked about the state of our young students on campuses these days. Do you think if I came in and said, if you continue with this, you're going to have back pain, so I suggest you start changing your ways, what do you think the compliance and effect would be? I'm going to, because I've done this, it's going to be just about zero. So once a person has back pain, it's too bad. I wish we had a better way. All of a sudden, they are now motivated to listen. They don't want to go back to that again. So this idea, it required the injury and the disability, unfortunately, to wake them up. Well, that, if you consider it in the right light, is the gift. Now, and I've proven this many times as well, because I'll stand by our record of restoring careers in professional sport around the world, many Olympic programs. I've had Olympic lifters, weightlifters. I know one fella who has 3 Olympic records. And he will say, I never hurt my back until I had a disc herniation. I never won a gold medal until I had a disc herniation, because that was the gift that taught me how to train pristinely and perfectly, understand the biological tipping points of my body, and understand the adaptation schedules. I can give you an example on that one as well. You'll find a lot of young people who get into bodybuilding, and when they go to powerlifting a little bit later in their life, they get hurt. And here's the typical mechanism. As a bodybuilder, typically they'll train 3 days a week, because what you're doing is creating adaptation to the muscle, and the muscle grows. But the muscle doesn't grow when you train. It grows in the day off between the training. So the whole training purpose is to create the adaptation on the rest day. Well, now let's go to powerlifting. When you examine the training schedules of the grand old men and women of powerlifting, what you'll find is you'll consider them undertrained. They will have a very heavy squat day, for example, and then they take 5 days off. but 5 days is what's required for the bone. When we measure the bone after a heavy squat day, at the molecular level, there's microfracturing that goes on, and it takes 5 days for the bone to go through its piezoelectric adaptation response. It draws in fresh calcium and magnesium ions. It scaffolds it into the bone and gets it to stick. That takes 5 days. So if you start training very, very heavy loads like a power lifter on a bodybuilding schedule of 3 days a week, the microfracturing actually accumulates. It doesn't have time for that adaptation. And then they come in with an end plate fracture in their back and wonder why now they have a disc bulge. Again, it wasn't a mystery. It was a violation of that biological process that no one had ever explained to them before. So anyway, there's again, just another example.
Yeah, well, I want to hit on something that I haven't talked about yet with you, which is the recovery phase or sleep. In first responders specifically, especially the firefighters where they're constantly up for 24 hours, or if they do the split schedule like the police do, then it's, you know, nights and days and nights and days. Do you see the effects of sleep deprivation, the inability to heal those micro tears more predominantly in first responders on those schedules?
Yes, absolutely. There's no question. But I see it at two different levels. The first level is the one that you're talking about with the actual disruption of the tissue adaptation and repair process. But what is also a concern, and you're probably well aware of the science on this, if you've been deprived of sleep, your performance actually goes to the level of being impaired with alcohol, for example. So now your movement patterns are not as pristine as before. It's like doing 10 deadlifts. Your last deadlift is now so poor in form, the stress concentrations on particular vulnerable tissues exceed the tipping point and you get hurt. So this is also a problem as well. As you know, if you're operating sleep deprived and you've got a very heavy lift to do, let's go into an apartment building now. It's on fire. There's a person who needs assistance out of their bathtub. You carry them down the stairs. You can imagine how you are highly perturbed if you've been sleep deprived.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing,
not to interrupt, James, but just again, that is a heroic Olympic effort. That's what you guys do on a regular basis. You perform heroic Olympic efforts. Now, if we were sending you to the Olympics to perform that, you would have been on a highly controlled diet, a highly controlled sleep schedule and rest schedule. Everything would be fit together to allow you to win without breaking your body in that heroic Olympic effort. But that's not what happens in the reality of your life.
Yeah.
So, of course it's a compromise.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for that. Because I think one of the ways that we are going to get our employers to understand that maybe the hours work, I mean, a lot of firefighters work 56-hour weeks, every third day they're awake, that if it's a financial concern, that we can show that if these men and women are given more time to recover and rest after these shifts, that down the road, the workplace injuries will probably be reduced as well.
Well, you used the word probably. I can be more strong in that, and I can prove reduction in injury rates. There's a fire department in California that they had a very, very good health and safety officer who happened to be responsible for the physical training of the fire department. And he documented the costs of back injuries falling to one quarter once they put together the programs and the principles that we've documented, first of all, in my clinical textbooks and then in my recent book for the lay public, Back Mechanic.
Brilliant. Which department was that, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I don't know if I should reveal the name. I'm hedging on whether they want the publicity or not. I'd have to call them and ask.
No problem. No problem. But that's the fact that you said that.
There might be a sensitivity there.
But the fact that you said that, that there had been a study done, and it's, you know, I'm talking to Dr. Stuart McGill, who's saying this, then that's really, you know, great to hear, because I only have hypotheses. You know, I'm sitting here in a house in Ocala. So, all right. Well, another thing you talked about as well about the weight bearing, breaking down, you know, micro tears, but then making bones stronger. I remember way, way back when I was doing exercise physiology in London, university there, they talked about that was the most effective way of keeping bone density strong and avoiding osteoporosis. So A, is that still the case? And B, what kind of exercises do you recommend to maintain that bone density, especially obviously in our female firefighters post-menopause?
Right. What a huge question. You may be aware that I was on the Osteoporosis Canada team that put together the recommended guidelines for stopping mineral loss. So I'm somewhat familiar with the science on this, although it isn't obviously my main area of expertise. But when I read the osteoporosis literature, it's almost always done on women who lead quite a sedentary life. They don't investigate the best and strongest female powerlifters in the world, for example. It's like my criticism of so much of what the medical profession knows about many medical conditions. They're measuring graduate students and sick people. There's not much difference sometimes. But when you measure the greatest athletes in the world, it's like driving an F1 race car. Now you suddenly learn what the automobile potential really is. And now can we bring that down to the mundane passenger car? So with that perspective said, the current feeling about bone density is that it's very important for young adolescent women to be quite active in an impact kind of way, run, jump, play basketball. It's that impact that densifies the bone, which the sweet spot for densifying bone is at 15. Now go to your local high school and look at all the mothers driving their kids to school. Right at the age when they had the biggest chance to create robust bone for the rest of their lives. So now we start to see something much more endemic and larger in scale. But now I'm going to get to the powerlifting story. So as I said, the current wisdom in the osteoporosis world is try and densify bone, and then for the rest of their lives, they can't really build bone. All they can do is stop the loss. And you stop the loss by walking with impact on the heels. In other words, have a stiffer soled shoe that actually gives you a little bit of a heel strike rather than these softened heels that take away all heel strike. That's not natural, and nor is it the best for the bones. But having said that, that world believes you can't build bone, but none of them, to my knowledge, have understood, measured, and worked with powerlifters. When I work with world-class strength women, so these are heavy field athletes and things like shot put, hammer throw, and then power lifters, they have heavy sclerotic bone, big welded plates. If you want to think of the bone actually grows plates rather than thin trabeculae in the vertebra. We see these in women who have power lifted and done it cleverly for many years. Absolutely, you can build bone with the right stimulus through training and the proper adaptation of that 5-day schedule that I was telling you about. So there's a perspective on why I believe the common street wisdom exists on osteoporosis and why I think it may not be entirely correct.
Right. And another area, and I'm not sure if this is something that you are, you know, well-versed in, but I know in some of the nutritional things I've read and documentaries I've seen, they talk about, you know, the way I was raised was you drink milk for healthy bones and strong teeth. We consume more dairy, I think we're number two in the world. There was another country ahead of us, like Hungary or something. But, you know, you would assume then if it was dietary that we would all have extremely strong bones. But then supposedly we have a very, very high incidence of osteoporosis compared to many countries. And again, I'm not 100% if that statistic is true. But fundamentally, I've been told that milk actually creates an acidity in the body, and then calcium is drawn from the bones to buffer that acidity. Through your studies, is what I said correct? Is it completely incorrect?
I don't know. That's not my world at all.
Okay. All right. Then I will delve some more. but another thing you said about was the shoes. I have personally, it feels good to me. I've started doing many of the things in the gym that aren't impact. So I'm not doing like a catch of a snatch or a clean, but slow squats and a lot of the other things I'll do barefoot now to try and create that connection with the floor again. Have you delved into the footwear side much?
Yes, but that's not a bone densifying rationale at all. To densify bone, you need impact. And just to give a scientific foundation for that and what causes bone growth and bone healing, bone is a piezoelectric crystal. So if you were, think back to when you were a kid at camp or whatever, at night, you would take two pieces of quartz and rub them together at night, and you would see lightning flashes going through the quartz. So what that was demonstrating was when you stress a piezoelectric crystal like quartz, it builds a charge, and then you liberate that charge when you take the stress off the crystal. So bone is a piezoelectric material. When you bend bone, it forms a charge at the highest stress point. That charge draws in free negative ions of calcium and magnesium and things like that, and it sticks the new ions onto the high stress point. So you actually lay down bone very cleverly at the highest stress point. Well, impact turns out to be one of the best signalers to lay down bone. So if you don't walk, that's a big problem. And if you walk in very soft air shoes or whatever you want to call those, you're taking out the shock that your body thrives on. So if you go barefoot or walk with more stiff heels, you will actually create more impact up through your articulated linkage to maintain that charge that lays down new bone. But that wasn't your question. Your question was really on footwear while you're lifting. Now we get into quite a different discussion. There's one, you said you wanted to be better connected to the ground. And that was a very clever thing to say, because now lifters, some put great priority in the proprioceptive system. So, for example, when you can grip the ground with your toes and your heels and really root, as it's called in the lifting world, and you create a good stiff spine with an appropriate hip hinge, this creates the highest density of neural drive. So your brain thinks of the movement and it sends out a volley of electrical pulses strategically throughout your body. That density determines your strength. If your body detects a poor root on the ground and you're slightly unable to control the center of mass and this and the base of support, your brain shuts down the neural drive. If it detects a little bit of instability in your low back through injury, it shuts down the neural drive to your hips. There's almost a fuse box there where your proprioceptive system says, you know, let's preserve this system because right now it's non-optimal. So now the next layer of discussion goes, what footwear creates the greatest root and therefore the potential for the greatest strength and neural drive? Well, now it's interesting. We get into the full spectrum of biological response. So some lifters, and how we just do the grand experiment. We put them into Olympic lifting shoes, which, as you know, have very stiff, either plastic or wooden soles in the shoes. They have a elevated heel and they have a buckle that goes over the top of the laces to really stiffen the foot and lock it down. And yet you will find other lifters who lift barefoot or in ballet slippers, the absolute polar opposite. They have a different proprioceptive and neurological system. So what we do is we'll give the lifter have two lifting sessions and we'll go back and forth. The first time they get really bound down tight in the Olympic lifting shoes. The next session they go to the ballet slippers and then we find out how did their system respond. And usually they're so aware, they say, no, you know, for me, I like the lifting shoes and the stiffness and connection I get there. And the next man or woman will say, no, I love barefoot. That really unleashes my neurology. So that's how we bracket it and discover what is best for the individual.
Okay, fantastic. Now I want to touch on one other area, moving away from that, before we do some wrap-up questions, because you've been very, very generous. I know we're getting on past the hour now. But you talked about the military changing their PT test. And obviously, one of the reasons is something that you're well known for discussing, which is the sit-up. So would you mind elaborating on that for me?
Yes. It's been military tradition for decades, particularly in the U.S., but around the world as well, to have speed sit-ups as part of the annual fitness test. Well, when you talk to some of the people, some of the physical therapists in the U.S. military, they will tell you that the soldiers train to pass the physical fitness test. And one report suggested that the number one cause of GIs returning from, I believe it was Afghanistan, it might have been Iran, I can't remember now, was a back pain associated with soldiers training the test. And every day I get emails from American military personnel saying, oh, I dread the test, it's coming up, I've hurt my back training for it, you know, do you have any suggestions? So listening to all of this, there's been some leadership in the military. I believe the Navy and factions of the Air Force have now taken out sit-ups. And they've replaced them with front planks, which has another issue because the front plank is limited by shoulder integrity. But anyway, and there was another group in the States. I know one of the military captains. Oh, she's probably a general by now, but Deidre Tayan was one of the officers in charge of the study. And they took soldiers in basic training. I believe it was Fort Bragg, but it was the one in Texas. Anyway, Fort Hood, maybe. They in basic training had some of the soldiers not doing sit-ups. Instead, they did exercises that we would recommend, front planks, the modified curls, which really isn't a curl up at all, stir the pod exercise on a gym ball, etc. And then at the end of basic training, they compared the two groups. The ones who didn't train sit-ups, but did it in spine-conserving ways, actually had higher athleticism, and they performed better on the sit-up test once it was administered. I also have enough experience in the world of MMA because, you know, we've restored careers of jiu-jitsu fighters and top MMA fighters who did, by tradition of karate and some of these other martial arts, they might do 1,000 sit-ups every day, which is fabulous until they're 22 or 23 years of age. And then all of that motion and stress is now accumulated, and they're so painful they can't practice jiu-jitsu on the floor, which requires bending their spine into flexion to go into guard and that kind of thing. So what we do is take out all of the sit-ups and replace them with stir the pot exercises and planks and rolling planks and these kinds of things. And lo and behold, they become even more athletic and their pain goes away. So there's a little bit of a start on the sit-up issue from a practical and applied point of view without really getting into the heavy discussion of how, for example, why do some people tolerate lots of sit-ups and the next person doesn't? Well, a quick explanation to start that one would be, if you took a thin willow branch, you could bend it back and forth with no stress. So it's not an issue. But if you took a thicker branch and bent it a few times to the same amount of bend, it would shatter right away because the stress in a round tube, which is the spine basically, is a function of its thickness or radial distance. So you would never, I hope, take an offensive tackle from the NFL and ask them to do sit-ups, because by definition they will have a heavier, thicker spine. Those are the ones that succumb much sooner than a very slender person who might be adept at gymnastics, for example, or they might be a yoga master, which is terrific, but they wouldn't last one play in surviving in the NFL. So, you know, there's wheels within wheels in understanding the nuances of programming exercise, why what is one person's poison is the next person's, you know, secret sauce to developing their athleticism. It's something I've spent my whole academic life in, trying to understand all the variables that come into play. So, you know, there isn't a single answer, but I keep coming back to this. Get a thorough assessment of the mechanism of the back pain, and that will show you, is sit-ups really the preferred exercise tool for you? Or would you be far more athletic with a stir the pot or a foam plank, or, you know, instead of doing a deadlift, you might be far more athletic and injury resilient if you simply pushed your car back and forth in the parking lot. You know, the people who only do deadlifts do that because that's the only tool they have in their toolbox, not realizing that there are many other ways that would be more clever in attempting to build a resilient high performance back and body.
Yeah. And I agree. The strongman type exercises, so the sled pushes and pulls and pulling the sled towards you with a thick rope and carrying sandbags, I found those have been great for me. But also when you take a step back and look at what we do on the fire ground, they're far more pertinent than standing there and cleaning or snatching or squatting, where you're never going left, right, like we would in real life.
Well, exactly. So the Canadian military, we consulted with them, a decade and a half ago, and they took out the speed sit-ups from their fitness test, and it is all strongman now. It's all sandbag carries and tire lifts and those kinds of things, because they're highly correlated with battleground performance.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I'm going to do some wrap-up questions then so we can let you go. But you've been an absolute wealth of information. Thank you so much. So the first question I always ask is, I'm going to list on the webpage that we have at jamesgeerian.com all of your books, and we'll talk about where we can find you in a minute as well. But are there any books by other people that you love to recommend, whether it's about what we've spoken about today or something completely different?
Well, you can't give me such an open question. I would need a parameter on that, and I might not be the best to recommend those. I know my area, and I'm confident to talk about that. To get into other areas like nutrition and some of these other things, I wouldn't be the expert to make those recommendations.
Okay, what about fiction then? Is there a fictional novel that you've loved that you've always told people?
I don't know if I've ever read a fictional novel in my life.
All right, we'll move on to the next one then. What about a movie and or a documentary?
I watch documentaries when I train. And it wasn't really a documentary. I found the testimony of James Comey the other night incredibly fascinating. I've watched a documentary on your president, which, again, I found very interesting. Warren Buffett. Good people are good for a reason. And once again, you see patterns. And it's a matter of pattern recognition. So I enjoy those kinds of documentaries on successful people and the reason for it.
Right. Okay. Now, is there a person that you would recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to talk to the police, fire, EMS, military of the world?
Yeah, absolutely. He's a wonderful speaker and one of the graduate students that worked with me both on the Toronto Police Force study and on the Pensacola study is a young professor, University of Toronto, Dave Frost. He would be a fabulous guest for you, for the first responders. He knows that world inside and out. He's a favorite guest for the, the IAFF, International Firefighters, whatever that one is. He's spoken to their medical groups many, many times. There are other people, though, that are really world leaders. Have you ever heard of Pavel Satsulin?
I have, yes, of Strong First.
Pavel is a Russian. I've known him many years. He knows strength. He's also a wonderful friend. He's taught me so much. He's been there, and he knows the science, and he knows how to put it in practice, and he loves working with first responders. He loves the toughness and that synergy of psychological and physical. Let me tell you a story of the first time I met Pavel. You'll enjoy this, at least the first responders will. I was a keynote speaker in Minneapolis at the National Strength and Conditioning Association, NSCA. And I did my talk, and after the talk, there was this large group of people, you know, that sort of descend on the podium at the end of these things to ask questions and whatnot. And people would ask me questions. And there was this fella in the back, and he said, "Sir, what do you think of this?" And he asked a big fella to lay on his back on the ground. And then he bent down, and he picked this guy up and just lifted him right up on his shoulder. And he said, "What did you think of that?" And I said, "That was perfect." And the people around me went, "Ooh, oh, that's terrible." And I said, "Sir, you did that absolutely perfectly." And, you know, in my own mind, there's no easy way to pick a body off the ground. But he did it perfectly, employing every principle perfectly. And so afterwards, of course, I was very intrigued on who this guy was. And we went to lunch. And long story short, we've been best friends ever since. So he would be a fabulous guest. Dan John, have you heard of Dan John?
You know, it's funny because I saw David Frost talk at TSAC, and I did a clinic with Dan John at TSAC as well.
Okay, so you know, look, it's a small world, but these are the stars that I'm describing. Dan John it's funny. We're both of the same age, same vintage, same sort of background, although he's a lot stronger than I am. But Dan just has good old-fashioned wisdom. He's just a sensible guy. He's able to take complex things and he makes them simple. Let me give you his statement on nutrition. Eat like an adult. Now, can you see how much wisdom that one sentence has? You know, if you asked me, you know, to make a statement on nutrition, it would be a 5-page report. And then Dan would say, oh, eat like an adult. And you know, it just makes so much sense. And his wisdom on rest and recovery and patterns of movement, it's just good old-fashioned wisdom. Anyway, I can go on and on, but there's three guests, I guess, for you that would be fabulous for your audience.
Yeah, I will genuinely reach out to all three of them. And I know I've had one of Pavel's master instructors, Zar Horton, who was a firefighter, I think he's a chief now in Albuquerque. And I had him on early on this podcast, and I'd love to reach out to Pavel because, I have several of his books, and I've used kettlebells for years too. And I think the man's a genius.
He is, and he's a wonderful human being as well. When you look at the number of careers he has started, you know, all these strength guys on the internet doing this and that, so many of them got their start with Pavel, and I don't hear very often him being credited, but he should get a tremendous amount of credit for what he's done in the whole world of resilient strength.
Absolutely. Well, it would be an honor if I was able to get him on. I will definitely work on that. So the very last question before we talk about where we can find all of your work is, what do you do to decompress, to blow off steam?
Oh, wow. What an insightful question. I used to do heavy physical exercise. So I would either train heavy or I would get on the heavy bag or something like that. And I used to joke with my wife that it was it kept me from committing murder. But someone was getting under my skin, I'd just go and train a bit. But what do I do now? That's interesting. I live in God's country. I live in Northern Ontario. So in the winter, I do outside things. And in the summer, I do boating and, just everything on the beautiful lakes here. And I love my dog and we go out and train and play. And it's just a habit. I have my little routine every day. The first thing I do is I get up, have a coffee and go for a long walk.
Brilliant. Yeah, I see. When I ask this question, I see a lot of common denominators too. And one of the big ones is just being out in nature, especially when people have a high stress job, you know, just to get out there and feel the sunshine on their face and cool air in their lungs. It seems to be very resetting for the soul.
Well, if you can train outdoors, it's magical. And that's exactly what we have here. We have our training center in my house, which happens to be downstairs. And out in the back, we've got chin-up bars and ropes between trees. There's kettlebells out there. I did have 1,000 pounds on an Olympic bar, believe it or not, but I just went and sold that. They were putting too many holes in my lawn out there. Oh, there's a sled out there to drag and
I agree as well. You know, why be in a big building with no windows when you can just be outside pushing things around in the grass or on the asphalt?
And also, you know, I'll another thing is I split my own firewood and I purposefully use a heavy splitting maul. And that is my training session. It's got just enough violence in it that, it takes down the psychological stress a bit. And that was a game I used to play with my graduate students. Some of them would train heavy and then they said, I'd say, come on over, let's split some firewood. And of course they had no idea. So the skinny old white haired professor would give them a lesson on super stiffness and how to create impact. And
that's something I said this to someone the other day in an interview as well. There's something very, masculine about chopping your own wood too. At the end of it, you feel quite accomplished.
Oh yeah, and there's not too much more that makes the beer taste good.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so then the most important question then, so how can people, after listening to this incredible interview, find your books, find the McGill Method and all the other platforms that you have online?
Yeah, well, thank you for that. Our website is backfitpro.com, and my books and DVDs and the various back supports that we've developed for people driving and whatnot are all on there, together with, we try and keep the content quite rich. People can also buy my books from Amazon, and there's numerous vendors around the world. But if you go to BackfitPro, the flags of the countries are on there, and if you're come from another country, you can click on your flag. But may I just talk about the books themselves for just a moment?
Please, yes.
Yeah. So I wrote my first book in the year 2000, and it was a heavy clinical textbook. I never in a million years thought I'd write for the lay public. So that was my first book. The second one was Ultimate Back Fitness and Performance. And again, I wrote that for the training crowd, the coaches, but people who had a little bit of savvy regarding training. And then the public asked me, and some publishers as well, would you write a book for the lay public? And that was something I'd never thought I would do. But I spent 5 years writing Back Mechanic. And it was the hardest book I wrote because I had to seek the balance between being truthful and honest versus making it simple enough for the lay public. The book publisher said, oh, this won't sell. You've got to have a title, Cure Your Back Pain in 5 Easy Steps. And I said, but that's a lie. Anyone who sells you that might get a couple of backs better by dumb luck, but it's not possible. And I'm not doing it. So I wrote Back Mechanic, which is 17 chapters, but it guides the reader through an understanding of the pain mechanisms. Then it guides them through a self-assessment of putting themselves into different motions, postures, and loads, and really getting an understanding of the category of pain mechanism. Then we show, based on their category, what they should stop doing and then what they need to do to build a pain-free foundation for whatever activity it is. But my last book, Gift of Injury, I wrote that with Brian Carroll. Brian is a highly accomplished strength athlete. He's the only lifter that I know of who's lifted over 1,000 pounds over 50 times in national and international competition. But he came to me with a horrible fracture. He'd split his sacrum front to back and crushed L5. And it was his story of what led to the injury and how we bone calloused all through clever matched exercise regimens. And then he spent another year getting his strength back. And he went back to win the Arnolds for the next 2 years after that. So you said you read it. It's a very emotional read. I found out Brian could write. And when I read the first chapter that he wrote on how he got to the very dark place that he got to with the injury, we then turned the book into a manual for recovery of the strength athlete. And again, that was never anticipated. It just grew organically as I learned what a great writer Brian was. So anyway, those are 4 books anyway. All have different purposes. But if you're struggling with back pain, start with Back Mechanic. If you're interested in then making the transition to redeveloping pain-free athleticism, if you're a strength athlete, go with a Gift of Injury. If you're an athlete or an occupational athlete, I would go more for Ultimate Back Fitness.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put all those books on the webpage, jamesgearian.com, for this episode. So they'll all be written down there, as well as the link for the website. So I just want to say thank you so much. I knew this was going to be an incredible interview, but there's just so much information here. And again, so many rabbit holes for people to decide which area they want to go down and then explore more about their own unique, whether it's pain or hopefully the prevention route if they haven't got to that point.
Well, terrific. Thank you very much, James. You got me with a couple of questions there that I normally don't get asked. So thanks for your thoughts in putting together your interview. And thanks once again as well for the support you provide to the first responders. I have to say, I love the community. I love working with the men and women. The jobs they do are, they are now getting their public recognition, but, when I see them on the street, I quite often go up to them and just thank them for all they do. So thank you for your support of not only what you do, but what you do for them as well.